Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today's episode is a weekly docket where we recap the headlines in true crime for the week. I've got about five or six stories ready for you guys. I've been hearing what you've been saying. A lot of you have been wanting to hear basically all of these stories that I'm going to talk about. The first one is one that is just dominating a lot of the headlines right now, and that is the story of Anna Kepner. So back in early November, a Florida family boarded the Carnival Horizon for what was supposed to be a six-day Caribbean cruise out of Miami. But by the time that the ship returned to Port Miami on November 8th, an 18-year-old girl, Anna Kepner, from Titusville, Florida, was dead. And now federal investigators are signaling that one of her teenage step-siblings may face criminal charges in connection with her death. Anna was a high school senior and varsity cheerleader at Temple Christian High School in Titusville. She was described by family and friends as outgoing, funny, and driven. She loved boating. She volunteered in her community and had already started the process to join the military after graduation with hopes of working in law enforcement as a K-9 officer. The trip itself was a family vacation on the Carnival Horizon. It was going to sail from Miami to the Caribbean and back. On board with Anna were her dad, Christopher Kepner, his wife, Chantel Hudson, and several of Chantel's children, so Anna's step-siblings. Now, according to multiple reports, on November 7th, Anna told her family she was not feeling well and went back to her cabin to rest instead of joining them for dinner. Then the next morning, when she didn't show up for breakfast, her family reported her missing to ship staff and a search of the vessel began. Just before midday, a housekeeper entered Anna's stateroom and made the discovery that turned this into a federal criminal investigation. Anna's body was found hidden under one of the cabin beds, wrapped in a blanket, and covered with life jackets. The Miami-Dade County Medical Examiner later documented her time of death as 11:17 a.m. that day. And I have a feeling that that is because that is when she was found, not when she was actually killed. But because the ship was in international waters and the victim was a U.S. citizen, the FBI took jurisdiction. Agents boarded the Horizon when it arrived in Miami on November 8th. They secured the cabin and began to collect evidence. Investigators have pulled ship security footage, electronic key card records, and other ship logs to reconstruct exactly who entered or exited Anna's room and when, and they have interviewed family members, passengers, and crew. Now, Carnival confirmed that a passenger had died on board and said that its focus was on supporting the family while deferring all questions about the circumstances to the FBI. The cruise line has not publicly released any additional details beyond the basic confirmation of the death and the fact that federal authorities are investigating. There are so many wild theories circulating online. Like, I'm on Facebook. I have a page on Facebook, Mama Mystery Podcast, and I follow some other true crime pages. And there's been so many allegations that maybe she was drugged or maybe she overdosed or that she was stabbed to death and that there's apparently surveillance footage that shows her two stepbrothers entering the room, one of the stepbrothers leaving, but leaving the other stepbrother in the room. And while all of this sounds salacious and like it could be true, nothing has been confirmed. So I say all this with like a grain of salt because we don't know exactly what happened and we might not know exactly what happened for a while. But on the medical side, Anna's body was turned over to the Miami-Dade County Medical Examiner after the ship docked. An autopsy has been completed, but officials have said that the cause and manner of death remain pending because probably there's some toxicology and additional testing that is still in progress. But as of this week, no official cause of death has been released to the public, and the FBI has not made any public statements about what they believe happened inside of that cabin. Now, naturally, the fact that her body was found wrapped in a blanket, hidden under a bed with life jackets on top, like obviously this all suggests that this was a homicide. But as far as exactly how she was killed, whether it was strangulation or stabbing, I've seen, alleged. We just don't know that yet. Now, Anna's father has spoken to several outlets saying that the family has been given almost no information about how or why she died, and that they only know what's been reported in the media, that she was found under the bed in her stateroom. And he has described the family as in the dark and has been publicly pressing for answers. The biggest development so far has come not from the FBI directly, but from a family court filing back in Brevard County, Florida. So in an emergency motion in her divorce and custody case, Anna's stepmother, Chantel Hudson, who was on the cruise, asked a judge to delay upcoming hearings because one of her minor children, who was on the cruise, may be facing criminal charges in connection with Anna's death. So obviously this piqued everybody's interest because this is obviously giving us some sort of clue as to who might be responsible for what happened to Anna. Now, according to that filing, Chantel says federal investigators told her, quote, a criminal case may be initiated, end quote, against one of her children, described in news reports as a step-sibling of Anna's, for conduct, quote, arising out of the sudden death of 18-year-old Anna Kepner aboard the Carnival Horizon. Now, some outlets have reported that the teen in question is a stepbrother, but law enforcement documents publicly available so far refer more generally to a minor step-sibling, and authorities have not released the child's name, age, or specific alleged conduct because they are a juvenile and have not been charged. So a lot of people are just kind of reaching for their own answers. And in a post that has since been taken down, Chantel actually took to Facebook to say, quote, this is a post no parent ever wants to make. I'm asking everyone to please stop sharing or posting about my daughter, Anna. We are trying to grieve the loss of our child, and it's been incredibly difficult to navigate this heartbreak while being overwhelmed with messages and friend requests. We truly appreciate everyone's love and concern, but right now we need privacy and space to grieve. Seeing hundreds of posts filled with inaccurate information and hurtful or off-the-wall comments has been incredibly difficult. We are a family simply trying to grieve the loss of our daughter. Please allow us the space and privacy we need during this heartbreaking time. End quote. Now, when I first saw that post, I shared it to my Facebook in hopes that it would maybe encourage people to kind of settle the dust a little bit and maybe stop spreading false information or, you know, assuming things. But there were a couple things that just struck me as odd, especially given what we know now about the family dynamic. So I'm going to break it down for you as simply as I can, because it does get a little confusing when you see so much going on Facebook. So Anna's biological parents are Heather Wright and Christopher Kepner. Together, they had a daughter, Anna, and then as time went on, they had a babysitter named Tabitha, who was about 15 at the time. Now, Christopher and Tabitha ended up kind of having this inappropriate relationship outside of Christopher's marriage to Heather. So Christopher and Heather break up, and then Christopher and Tabitha end up together, but not without a fight. So Tabitha's mom actually pressed charges against Christopher. Back in 2008, the charge was for sexual violence, but the charges were later dismissed. And then Christopher and Tabitha ended up getting married. Well, eventually Christopher and Tabitha split up, and then Christopher met and married Chantel. Chantel has children from a previous marriage, and it is one of those sons that she brought from that previous marriage who stands accused of whatever happened to Anna, allegedly for educational purposes only. He hasn't actually been formally charged with anything, but it seems like this is where everything is going. Now, there was a post made by another family member named Martin Donahue. So to connect all the dots, it is my belief, I don't have it 100% confirmed, but Martin Donahue is somehow related to Tabitha, maybe their brother and sister or something like that. But Martin Donahue calls himself Anna's uncle. He went to Facebook and said, quote, I need everyone's help on this. If you haven't heard this story, then you have been living under a rock. I cannot stay silent about this matter any longer. The stepmom's son killed her, stuffed her under a bed, and covered her with life jackets, then slept on that bed like nothing happened. He told his mom where no one could find Anna on the ship. So yes, they know who did this, and it sickens me that the father, Chris, remains silent about it. Please pass this on till maybe it gets to someone that can do something about it. If nothing is done, it will all come out on the 20th, which is actually today as I'm recording this, that it'll come out on the 20th. At least that's what the stepmom has said after treating family. If they talk, before that they will be banned from the Remembrance of Life for Anna. Please pass this on so my family can get closure and the people who did this and lied and stalled to tell the rest of us what happened when it did. Now you all just look guilty of a cover-up." End quote. Now, obviously, there's like some syntax errors, but we get the point of what he's saying. And it seems like there is definitely some divide between Christopher and Chantel and essentially the rest of the family. As for Anna's biological mom, it does not seem like they have a solid relationship. When I looked at Anna's obituary, it actually labeled Tabitha as Anna's mom, even though we know that Heather is the biological mom. So obviously this is like a messy family dynamic, but right now that is as far as public record goes. An unexplained death on a cruise ship, a body that was hidden under a bed, an autopsy with results that are still pending, and a court document that indicates that the FBI is actively weighing a criminal case against one of Anna's teenage siblings. Now, no arrests have been announced, no charges have been filed, and investigators have not said whether they believe Anna's death was the result of violence, intoxication, an accident, or some combination of factors. So as the investigation continues, Anna's family and community in Titusville are preparing to lay her to rest. A celebration of life has been scheduled in her hometown with friends and classmates asked to wear bright colors in honor of the way she lived. Meanwhile, the FBI, the medical examiner, and federal prosecutors will be the ones to decide whether this remains a mysterious death at sea or becomes a criminal case centered on whatever happened in that tiny cruise ship cabin. I've also seen some posts from people who live in the Titusville area that show Anna's car covered in flowers in remembrance of her. And so many people have been messaging me about this case, one of whom is Brittany Byer. So thank you so much for helping me by sharing things that you're seeing as well. I always accept anyone who, you know, offers pieces of evidence or posts that maybe I haven't seen. So if you ever have anything to offer, please, I always welcome it. But this story is obviously evolving, and I will keep you updated for sure. Now, on to the next story. This is another one that was heavily requested when I asked what you all wanted to see in the weekly docket. This is a story about Mary Beth Lewis out of New York. She's 68 years old, she was a nurse, and she is now at the center of one of the more unusual custody and criminal cases to come through the Steuben County court in recent years. She has 13 biological children already. She's 68 years old, okay? Now she is fighting both felony charges and county officials for the right to raise the twins that she calls her 14th and 15th children. So Mary Beth and her husband, Bob Lewis, live in Elma, New York. She is a longtime nurse. He is a retired FedEx pilot. And by 2010, they already had 8 children. And at the time, a local paper in East Aurora profiled the family when their 8th child was born. It was actually their 8th daughter in a row. And this article quoted Mary Beth joking that once you're making food for one child, making food for another isn't such a big jump, which I beg to differ. I have 4 kids and I feel like my grocery bill is at an all-time high. If I literally tripled that number, that is a big jump. So I don't know what you're talking about, Mary Beth. But at the time, she said they were done growing their family and that her hands were full. But the family did not stop at 8. And according to a detailed New York Times profile that summarized in court and media reports, the couple used IVF after their first 5 children and then relied on a mix of their own embryos plus donor eggs and sperm for later pregnancies. Mary Beth carried every pregnancy herself, including multiple sets of twins. And after that 8th baby in 2010, she gave birth to twin boys in 2012. In 2016, at the age of 59, she delivered another set of twins, bringing the total to 12. Then several years later, she gave birth again at age 62 to what she counts as her 13th child. Okay, well, that's not where this story ends, okay? The current legal battle stems from what came next. There were still frozen embryos left, and Mary Beth says that she could not bring herself to have them destroyed. By this point, she was no longer medically a candidate to carry a pregnancy. I'm sorry, I laugh because I had a baby at age 36 and I was considered a geriatric pregnancy. So I don't know what you would consider having a baby in your 60s, but it can't possibly be good and healthy. So at this point, they're like, you are too old to be doing this. So in 2023, she turned to surrogacy. She arranged for a woman to carry twins conceived using donor embryos. The surrogacy arrangement ran through a clinic and involved court oversight in Steuben County, which handles many surrogacy parentage orders in New York. But prosecutors now allege that Mary Beth pushed this surrogacy forward without her husband's knowledge in ways that crossed into fraud. According to the indictment in Steuben County, she is accused of forging her husband Bob's signature on surrogacy paperwork despite New York law requiring both intended parents to consent. She is also accused of later posing as him during a remote court hearing. At a Zoom parentage hearing in September of 2023, she allegedly logged in a second time under an account that was labeled as her husband and then left the camera off and responded for him when the judge addressed Bob. So days later, Bob opens the mail at home and discovered a court order establishing parentage for twins that he didn't even know were on the way. So according to the reporting, he was furious and contacted the lawyer who had been handling the surrogacy, who then in turn alerted the judge. That disclosure triggered a wider investigation by New York State Police and the Steuben County District Attorney's Office into whether documents had been falsified to push this surrogacy through. In December of 2023, a Steuben County grand jury returned a 30-count indictment against Mary Beth. The charges include 2 counts of attempted kidnapping in the second degree, 6 counts of second-degree forgery, 5 counts of tampering with physical evidence, 4 counts of first-degree falsifying business records, 3 counts of offering a false instrument for filing, 3 counts of first-degree tampering with public records, 1 count of attempted tampering with public records, 4 counts of second-degree perjury, 1 count of first-degree criminal impersonation, and 1 count of first-degree identity theft and a partridge in a pear tree. She pleaded not guilty to all counts and was ordered to return to court in early 2024. Orders of protection were put in place in favor of the 2 infants from that surrogacy pregnancy. Now, by that time, the twins, a boy and a girl born in 2023, had already been placed with foster parents. County social services officials moved to block Mary Beth and Bob from taking custody, arguing in court that the state cannot simply overlook the alleged crimes committed in the process of quote unquote creating life and then reward the conduct by placing the children with the person accused of that fraud. So the twins have remained with their foster family while the criminal case and a parallel custody battle work through the family court. Now, the legal proceedings have been very messy and expensive. Prosecutors offered Mary Beth 2 plea deals, but she turned both down because she wants to keep fighting for the right to raise the twins. She has admitted she does not feel good about how she handled parts of the surrogacy process, but she insists that she is being treated unfairly and that her core motive was to give life to embryos that she viewed as future children. Now, over time, Bob's stance has shifted. He initially opposed having more children and was blindsided by the surrogacy and the court order, but now he supports Mary Beth's battle for custody of the twins. Several of their older children have also spoken up on her behalf, describing her as flawed but loving and insisting that she has always been devoted to her kids. The surrogate who carried the twins has also backed Mary Beth's efforts to regain custody. Now, on the other side, the foster parents caring for the twins have also gone on record through statements relayed in court and in the New York Times story that covered this case, saying that their focus is on the children's safety and stability. The foster mother has described the twins as ordinary toddlers who like picture books such as Brown Bear, What Do You See?, and who just turned 2 years old this month. The foster father has written that he hopes media coverage of the case will prioritize the best interests of 2 very precious children. Judges and lawyers across the case have described the legal issues as unusually tangled, That's putting it quite lightly, I think. And the district attorney, Brooks T. Baker, told reporters that it was one of those files where the first reaction was to ask if it was even real, because the list of allegations and the way that they intersect with reproductive technology and family law is just so unusual. So I'm sure whatever happens in this case will set a precedent. But as of mid-November of 2025, the situation is essentially that a new family court judge has ruled that Mary Beth and Bob Lewis are, as a matter of law, the parents of the twins. That ruling does not automatically hand them custody, though. The foster family has filed an appeal, and the children remain in foster care while that appeal and the criminal case against Mary Beth continue. So she still faces the full slate of felony charges out of Steuben County, and there has been no public announcement of any plea agreement or dismissal. So I want to know what your thoughts are on this, because, I mean, bringing children into the world so late in life and under false pretenses, you know, by means of fraud, it doesn't exactly give me a lot of hope that these kids stand a chance to have a great life in that home, especially when the dad was completely unaware and pissed when he found out about it, understandably so. But I mean, I don't know. I'm kind of like, I could see this going either way, but ultimately I just feel bad for these babies who were brought into the world against their own will and just thrust into this mess of a situation. Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com. Which honestly is a perfect segue into this next story. So if you follow me on social media, you've already seen me talk about the 14-year-old girl who was found weighing only 35 pounds in a house of human toads. Okay, these human toads are Walter Goodman, Savannah Lefevre, and Kayla Stemler. Back in August, a 14-year-old girl, known by her initials as MJG, was rushed to the hospital after her father, Walter Sam Goodman, called 911. She was living with her father, Walter, at the time, her stepmother, Melissa Goodman, her adult stepsister, Savannah Lefevre, and Savannah's partner, Kayla. MJG had no contact at all with her biological mother. Now, MJG had been living in Walter's trailer since spring of 2020, and Kayla moved in during August of 2021. So by 2025, the home kind of looked like this. There was Walter, who was severely obese and was suffering from cirrhosis of the liver and apparently awaiting a transplant. Then you had Melissa and Savannah, who were also described as being extremely obese and nearly bedbound. And then you had Kayla, the partner, who was the only adult leaving the house to go to work, but was also very, very overweight. And if you're wondering why I think it's important to note that, it's because this poor girl at 14 years old was being starved while her entire family ate the entire house right in front of her. MJG was isolated, she was locked in her room, and she was mostly monitored by cameras. So on this day that Walter calls 911, he immediately starts making excuses for how MJ looks. He tells the dispatcher, quote, "I have a 14-year-old daughter that she don't barely eat, so she looks really skinny. She's autistic, so if she don't want to eat, she don't eat. The last 4 or 5 days, she's been sick, throwing up, but today she's really lethargic, laying there like she's comatose, but her eyes are open," end quote. So the way that he is describing her appearance off the bat, it's almost like he knew first responders would be stunned when they saw her. And they were. When officers arrived, they found MJG so emaciated that she looked like she was the size of a 6 to 8 year old, with visible bones protruding all over her body. Her blood sugar level was 24, which is a level that is so low it can cause seizures, coma, or even death. She weighed 35 pounds. Her father admitted that when she wasn't waking up or responding, he thought maybe her blood sugar was low, so he gave her wild cherry Pepsi before EMS arrived. When an officer asked where her mother was, Walter just said, "She's a whore." Like, that's not what they asked. And then he repeatedly insisted that MJG was only so thin because she, quote, "never sleeps," end quote. Just kept repeating. I mean, I've read the whole transcript. He just kept saying, "She's skinny because she doesn't sleep. She's skinny because she doesn't sleep. She doesn't eat because she doesn't talk because she doesn't sleep." And it's just like, or maybe it's because you guys are keeping her locked up in her room and you're refusing to let her eat, which is what they later discovered. So when she was at the hospital, doctors found her to be in critical condition with severe starvation, multiple organ failure, hypothermia, pressure sores, vitamin deficiencies, osteoporosis and bone fractures, several muscle wasting and contractures, which is when your muscles and everything is so depleted from nutrients that they begin to tighten up and you kind of hunch over, almost like you sometimes see like really old people that are just kind of contracted, you know. And she had had no medical care since the year 2020. She also showed signs of long-term confinement and immobility. Doctors said that she had endured months to years of starvation. And when she was finally fed normally in the hospital, she gained nearly 20 pounds in just weeks, proving that she had simply been denied adequate food. She told nurses that she loved food and that she was excited to eat, but she also said, quote, "My dad will be so mad if he finds out I ate this much," end quote. So when they investigated the home, they discovered that MJG was routinely locked in her bedroom from the outside. She was monitored by cameras. She was denied food and water as a punishment. She was taken to the bathroom only when she was allowed. So there were multiple times that she was forced to urinate in her own pants or her own bed. She was forced to lie on the floor with no bed at times. She was yelled at, mocked, and ignored when she cried out in pain. But the most damning evidence came from when the Toad's text messages were revealed. They constantly called her things like dummy, stupid, idiot, and piece of shit. They would text each other saying, "Make sure dummy's door is locked." Another text read, "Has stupid been laying right?" Another text, "Stupid's crying. She's so stupid. I hate her. I want to karate kick her dumb head," which is ironic considering none of them looked like they've lifted a foot off the floor more than 6 inches in years. But they also said things like, "Is she supposed to pee or just poop?" And then Melissa would respond saying, "She can do both." Savannah responds, "She screamed she has to pee, but she just went at 2:30. So they weren't going to let her use the bathroom more than once in a certain amount of time, apparently. And then Melissa responded saying, "Tell her to crawl to her room." Savannah responded saying, "She fell and cried. So stupid." They admitted locking her in her room, saying things like, "Make sure her door is locked. Unlock stupid's door for me." So they're not even calling her by name. They're calling her stupid as if stupid is her name. They said she is not to be out of her room at all. And then investigators later found a bolt lock that matched screw holes on MJG's door, confirming that they physically locked her inside of her room. They withheld food and bragged about punishing her, saying things like, "We're phasing out serving her right away. If she acts up, she gets the bed taken away and lays on the floor." Kayla at one point said, "She argued, so I used the belt." Melissa responds, "That's fine, she deserved it." And then another text says, "If she doesn't stop, she will not eat." Savannah even wrote, quote, "She looks horrible. I'm scared she's going to die. We're all going to go to jail," end quote. But they still never took her to a doctor. They openly hated her. At one point, and this is the most heartbreaking text, MJ on her birthday quietly said, "Well, I'm officially 14. According to the text messages, Walter responded, her freaking dad said, "We know you're 14. We don't care," end quote. Now, Walter Goodman, Savannah Lefevre, and Kayla Stemmler have all been arrested and charged with chronic neglect of a child. A fourth suspect was in custody and also expected to face charges. My belief was that it would be Melissa, and it was later confirmed the next day that it was, in fact, the stepmother, Melissa, that was arrested and charged. Now, the four charged suspects made their first court appearances last week, and the presiding commissioner, Brian Figge, set $150,000 cash bonds for Walter Goodman and Lefevre, and then a $100,000 bond for Kayla. So obviously this case is still pretty fresh. They're still going through the court system, and this could take a minute depending on if they choose to plead guilty or not guilty. I will keep you updated on this case, but my hope for this 14-year-old girl is that she has a life ahead of her that is filled with more than what she's been given so far. This child endured years of starvation, confinement, humiliation, and physical deterioration while surrounded by adults who had every chance to save her. They even acknowledged that she looked terrible and that she obviously was ill, and yet they all chose cruelty instead, which is absolutely heartbreaking. With that, I'd like to segue into something that has a little bit better of a happier ending, I guess you could say. So over the course of a two-week operation this month, a joint task force that was led by the United States Marshals Service joined forces with state and local law enforcement, child welfare agencies, and non-government partners across the state of Florida to locate and safely recover 122 missing or endangered children. The operation, formerly dubbed Operation Home for the Holidays, was officially announced on November 17th from Tampa, Florida. Now, according to the announcements, the children ranged in age from 23 months old to 17 years old. Among them, 57 were located in the Tampa Bay region, 14 in the Orlando area, 22 in the Jacksonville region, and 29 in the Fort Myers region. Recoveries also occurred in 9 other states beyond Florida, although the publicly released data did not break down the out-of-state numbers. The task force emphasized from the outset that while finding the children was the immediate goal, the operation was structured to ensure rapid transition into care and support. So children were transferred to safe locations, connected with medical care, youth advocacy, foster care, or other placements, and juvenile justice coordination as needed. Many of the children located were already known to Florida's child welfare system. They were recipients of services from the Florida Department of Children and Families and the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice or healthcare programs. During a press briefing, U.S. Marshal Bill Berger said that the guiding principle was simple. He said, quote, "We know these children will have needs once we find them. It only makes sense to build these operations alongside like-minded partners from across the child welfare space," end quote. The scope of what the children had experienced was spelled out in the public statements. Authorities confirmed that many of the recovered youth had been subjected to abuse, neglect, exploitation, or exposure to criminal environments. Among the pool of cases that were highlighted, one young girl who was pregnant and still a minor received prenatal care for the first time under the operation. Two brothers received initial care for substance dependency issues and were being evaluated for longer-term treatment. A toddler was located in Mexico, and U.S. and Mexican authorities coordinated her safe return. And a young man with significant juvenile justice involvement was directed into services for alleged abuse exposure. Criminal work is already underway. At the time of the announcement, six individuals had been arrested on felony charges connected with the operation. The charges publicly cited included child neglect, custodial interference, narcotics possession, sexual assault, terroristic threats, and endangerment. Officials stated that several more investigations remain open, with additional felony arrests expected. Attorney General Utmeyer called the initiative, quote, one of the single largest child rescue operations in U.S. history, and stressed the message to predators that, quote, if you come into Florida and you prey upon our kids, you are not welcome here, end quote. So while it is a beautiful story that these children were rescued, the work doesn't stop here. And obviously there's going to have to be a lot of downstream work, like returning the children to safe and stable environments and diagnosing and treating the trauma that they've been through and ensuring that rescue is only the beginning of recovery. While the exact names, ages, and outcomes of each child remain shielded for privacy and protection, the operation's publicly released figures and details offer a pretty clear picture that over 120 children were removed from imminent risk with coordinated law enforcement and service provider involvement and multiple criminal prosecutions underway. So the work ahead is complex, but for these children, the spotlight has shifted from disappearance to hopefully a sense of hope. Now, this last story is quite unusual, and I want to hear your take on this story. It reminds me of a story that I've told on this podcast before. Maybe some of you will remember it, but this story is about Sonia Exelby. She was a woman in her early 30s from Portsmouth, England, and she traveled to Florida in October with the stated intention of being abused and possibly killed, according to investigators. So on October 10th, she landed at Gainesville Regional Airport and did not show up for her scheduled return flight back to the UK, which prompted concern and a missing person alert. Her remains were discovered in Marion Oaks, Florida, after authorities determined that she had died from what they have recorded as a homicide. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement has since filed charges against Dwayne Hall, a 53-year-old man who lived in Florida. He is charged with murder and kidnapping in addition to earlier fraud charges that are linked to this case. The case files show a pretty heavy involvement of digital evidence. Investigators reviewed emails, chat logs, and video recordings that indicated Sonia had been seeking death, including a document on her computer where she wrote that she was, quote, suicidal and traveling to the United States to be sexually abused, tortured, and possibly murdered, end quote. Authorities allege that Sonia and Dwayne first connected about 2 years ago on a fetish website. At an interview, Hall admitted that he did know her, that he had sex with her on multiple occasions, and then discussed with her topics of bondage, suicide, and her desire to be killed, although he claims he did not kill her. Now, among the most troubling pieces of evidence are video recordings, one of which allegedly shows Dwayne prompting Sonia to express a desire to die, with her answering yes, though in a hesitant tone. Investigators allege that in messages to a friend, Sonia wrote that she was being held against her will and that the only way out was to shoot someone, and that she had been coerced into writing messages and letters for her family under his direction. As for the financial trail, Dwayne is accused of trying to transfer large sums from Sonia's bank account after October 11th, which is the date investigators say matched the time frame, of her disappearance. He was initially arrested on fraud-related charges and then was indicted for murder and kidnapping once the scope of the investigation widened, and he has pleaded not guilty. Sonia's own writings reflect active suicidal intent and specific planning. For instance, she wrote that she anticipated being, quote, mutilated and disabled for the rest of my life. But investigators are treating Dwayne's alleged actions not simply as a consensual encounter gone wrong, but as abuse and exploitation of a suicidal person and homicide. So for now, the case is still unfolding. The FDLE has not publicly specified the cause of death beyond homicide, nor have they released a full accounting of the evidence that will be used in court. The next major steps will include pretrial hearings, possible disclosure of forensic details, and a determination of whether the prosecution will allege premeditation or an assisted death scenario. So I guess I would be curious to see what writings took place before she came to Florida, if that really was her intent. I know that this has happened before, that there's like these fetishes where there was a woman, let me see if I can find her name, Sharon Lopatka. So I covered this story in episode 107. This was back in October of 2022. And she essentially kind of had the same thing. It was this twisted fantasy that ended up costing her her life, but she alleges that like this is really what she wanted and this is how she wanted to go out. So I don't know. I fear that in this case, maybe she expressed interest in this type of fantasy, but then maybe had regrets once it actually came time to, you know, show up for this fantasy. So I don't know what'll end up happening here, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts. It sounds like from her communication while she was in Florida that she was having regrets and wanted to go back home. And if she planned to come to Florida to die, then why would she purchase a return flight? So I'm sure all of this will come up in court proceedings that are, you know, coming soon, I'm sure, but I'll keep you guys updated if you'd like. That is it for today's weekly docket. Thank you so much for listening. And if you ever want to request a story, go to mamamystery.com and you can send me a message through that white box. If you want me to know who you are, you'll have to put it in the message. Otherwise, I will not know. But I thank you so much for your support, your loyalty, and your listenership to this podcast. I hope you all have a great weekend. Stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out.